Terrific. Thank you. Thank you all for joining us. So our subject on the table is university and RIAA. A big question, set of questions, legal questions, technical questions, moral questions. I think that we are interpreting that as the file sharing debate and what should the university's role be in that discussion. And maybe we should start out by laying about a bit of the legal and historical background of where we are right now and how we got here. Would that be helpful?
Teachers.
Teacher, proceed. Yes.
We may vaguely remember Napster, the original, the first widely popular peer-to-peer file sharing application. First made it easy for students and others on fast networks to upload and download music. And although Napster was sued out of existence, it was quickly followed by further decentralized sharing applications, so that now students and others easily can exchange music files with authorization of their copyright holders, files without authorization of their copyright holders, raising concerns from major copyright holders and representatives of copyright holders that this is eroding their rights under the law, their business models, and their markets. So the university has gotten called out in these discussions as a central point to which claims can be made, on which demands can be placed, and where action might be taken to stop the file sharing. So the university is in multiple roles here. It's a network provider to lots of students, often providing them with very fast connections to the network. So it might be in a position to stop them from accessing certain network resources. It might be in a position to track their access to network resources. It might be in a position to cut off access to the network, and has been asked at various times to do all of those things. It's also, of course, an educational institution and an institution that's called upon to provide moral guidance to students, and so it's been called upon in that role to educate students about copyright, to tell them, warn them against copyright infringement, use its moral powers, again, often coupled with sanction, to get them to stop. So the recording industry, the legal landscape has been first lawsuits against the software companies, the Napsters, and followed by Grokster and Streamcast and Kazaa. And each time you strike at one of these file sharing software companies, the network gets further decentralized. If you strike at a Grokster, you can stop the company from continuing to distribute the software on a claim that they are inducing copyright infringement, but the software is still out there and continues to function. So the company doesn't make an easy target for stopping the activity. Well, the network providers can often identify their users. So recording companies have come in first with subpoenas to the network providers to identify their users under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and in a sort of because of the statutory language there, the courts held that those who merely who provided connectivity to users, as distinct from those who hosted material on the network, didn't have to respond to these subpoenas and identify users on their networks. But that doesn't stop the requests for identity. It just turns them into a file a lawsuit against numerous John Does who are using a particular network's services, and then in conjunction with that lawsuit, seek discovery of the identity of the people behind it. And since universities are providing lots of fast network connections and lots of serve lots of music consumers, that they've faced some of these, their students have faced some of these John Doe lawsuits and subsequent identifications. From there, the recording companies have moved on to pre-litigation demands to universities. If they can't come in with a legal subpoena, perhaps a pre-litigation demand requesting that you inform your student at a particular IP address that the recording industry has identified him or her as a copyright infringer. Please let student know that you can come to this settlement address for more information on settling his claims, or if not, the record labels will file a lawsuit and pursuant to that get the identity and presumably make it more expensive for the student to fight the lawsuit or settle afterwards.
Wendy, I have a question.
Please, jump in.
Thank you. A couple of weeks ago in Mr. Reed's Fine Wired Campus column, you and Professor Nessen were alleged to have suggested that colleges and universities should somehow resist the John Doe subpoenas. Those are not the fast track ones, but the ones that come through the commencement of litigation. Could you explain to me why you and Professor Nessen thought that was in the interest of universities?
Sure. Do we want to do any? That's pretty. I guess I pretty much got the background of where we are now. So yes, I am not a neutral moderator here, and I won't pretend or purport to be on this issue. I've taken this argued that the university's role should not be to assist the recording industry in identifying its students or to shoulder the burden of passing on those notices to the students and helping the copyright holders to enforce their copyrights, but that conflicts with various of the university's educational missions. In order to identify the students, they are asked to put tracking into their network that's recording students' IP addresses and network activity so that they can trace back the IP address when a complaint comes in. I don't think that's sort of helpful to the mission of encouraging exploration of the network.
But you know those things that existed long before the recording industry sent us preservation notices or subpoenas for identity. That's used for maintaining the network function. At least for some period of time, usually one needs to retain its records.
I don't think she finished answering your question.
No, she didn't, but I didn't know that.
I'm willing to.
I just want to chat.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I would urge in other circumstances too that those records be limited and that their use be limited to genuine cases of network abuse rather than uses that make students feel that their browsing is being monitored.
Maintaining logs isn't monitoring.
Depends on the logs, but the logs of DHCP matching is not monitoring.
Oh, certainly one could monitor network. This is not that.
Many of us went doing DHCP logging forever.
Right.
Long before the DMCA came along for network abuse issues.
I think this was only point one of Wendy's description of why she feels. Before we get into this grain.
I just think you have something you wanted to say also, did you not?
I do, but I think you have a fuller case for the resistance.
Thank you for those helpful leading questions. The broader case that I would make is that we need to go deeper into examining the costs of enforcing this regime of intellectual property. That if preserving copyrights in recorded music means forcing universities to monitor student activity or to restrict network use or to restrict technology use and to take on the burdens of responding to complaints in this way, that's outsourcing a lot of the costs of defending a property right. Property rights in the economic theory, property rights are efficient ways of internalizing the costs of resource use, and where intellectual property is pushing those costs onto others, maybe overall that's not the best way to give incentive to creative work. I will hasten to say that I think we need to find ways to continue to pay the artists and encourage those who are making creative work. I don't think we should be saying this is a free-for-all. If you can get it, you should take it, and leave the artists and entertainment companies entirely out in the cold.
Well, if I may just respond, then.
I
emphatically agree with you about technological monitoring and other devices for filtering and that kind of thing. And maybe the little clip that got publicized didn't have the longer description of all of the things to which you're objecting, but it was curious for some of us who have been working very hard in higher education from the administrative point of view in striking the right balance to maintain our missions and comply with the law, that the suggestion from the Berkman Center be that we not comply with a legal subpoena. And so I was just, that's why I asked the question, because I think that to focus on that issue seems, from the administrative point of view, to be a losing battle, whereas there are battles that we really must fight, such as the one next week in Congress when technological innovations will be heavily endorsed on the part of the content industry, that kind of thing. So I was wondering why the focus was on just answering a simple subpoena versus the really big issues, such as technological filters.
In the first place, I think if Dr. Seltzer and Professor Nessen had... I'm sorry. If Ms. Seltzer and Professor Nessen had, who are practicing attorneys, had advised Harvard University to disobey a lawful subpoena, I think that would have been much bigger news than it was treated as. It would have been across the world. It wasn't their advice. Their advice was to provide assistance in defending students. There were some very profound reasons expressed by them in that article. There are a lot of other possibly less profound articles that I could give. For example, the fact that the student has the university has a role within the student's life that will last for the rest of the student's life, for their entire career. And has when the university would take a letter, which is not a lawful subpoena, it's a letter that's trying to extort money from people and just pass that along to them and say, do what you will with it. It has a strong suggestion to the students that they're being asked to comply, putting the university in the position of assisting the record industry in the collection. Secondly, the way they bring the John Doe cases reeks of procedural unfairness. It's done in such a way as to ensure a lack of notice. It's done ex parte, contrary to the principles of the federal of the rules of the federal rules of civil procedure. That's you're only supposed to do something ex parte if it's absolutely necessary. In this case, it is not in any way necessary. It's done strictly for a strategic advantage. The RIA could as easily as it now provides, the students will receive notice maybe days before, sometimes even days afterward, of when they were supposed to make a motion to quash, a proceeding they knew nothing about, in which they never received a single set of papers, but they have been defendants as John Doe. The university could just as easily have made the motion on notice and provided Harvard with copies of the summons and complaint, the underlying rules of the court, and with copies of the motion for discovery and all of the affidavits and exhibits and whatever they have that they say gives them a right to this discovery, and say, Harvard, send that to the students and tell them that they'll have 20 days or 30 days to respond to that. Or else the judge is going to give such an order. Instead of doing that, they go to the court. They won't tell Harvard. Or I don't know why we're talking about Harvard. Harvard's the one school they're afraid to come after. They will never come after Harvard. There's a reason why they never came after Harvard. And I'm sure there were more file shares here than anywhere else. They will never come after Harvard.
We certainly get DMCA complaints and subpoenas.
Right, but you haven't received you haven't received the settlement letters. You haven't received the John Doe proceedings, and you never will.
There's a lot of discussion about what the students are thinking. So I think it'd be interesting to push the discussion into what the students are thinking.
I can't finish what I was going to say.
Sorry.
So this is this deliberate lack of notice, completely consistent with due process, with our American standards. The universities should not be allowing the students' rights to be trampled on that way. I'm not saying they should defend someone in a copyright infringement suit. They should say, if I were a parent and the school gave away my child's due process rights, I would be very upset. And they should be protecting the due process. And they're in a position to say to the RIA, we'll comply with your thing, we'll send out the things you want, we will do things, but this is what you will do. You will give prior notice if you decide to bring a lawsuit, not subsequent notice. You're going to give our university a chance to respond, and you're going to give the students a chance to respond. You're going to give us copies of all the papers, and you're going to give us prior notice. And they could demand that. And if the RIA refused it, they could go to the judge and get the judge to sign an order like that in 2 seconds. And that's another reason. Another reason is the procedural unfairness of multiple John Does. It's against the law to join unrelated defendants in the case. They were ordered to cease and desist from that practice in 2004, and yet they continue to do it. They're supposed to be suing one. So why shouldn't the university and its legal offices be protecting the students' rights in that respect? then as an expert in the technical stuff, you know that the precision of identification of who is using a specific dynamic IP address at any given moment in time, which is what most of this identification of the back is riddled with uncertainty. Yesterday I received a letter. It has been riddled with uncertainty.
Depends
I received all kinds of materials and affidavits. The RIA itself has specifically stated in its letter to ISPs, similar to the one it sent to universities, that they've received numerous misidentifications.
It depends on the specifics of the environment. Some of them are completely ridiculous in terms of reliability. Some are pretty tight. Ours happens to be in some places pretty tight, in other places not.
The reason which had popped into my mind was the fact that these cases are all based upon alleged file sharing, but not downloading, not uploading. Just the mere fact that files were vividly eligible. And as Ms. Seltzer knows, and most players here know, that's something that is a completely nebulous concept. It has no place in the Copyright Act. There's no established basis for it, and yet that's what these lawsuits are based upon, which is another reason why the schools should be involved in defending students, because they're being, the only evidence the RIA has is of something which is probably not even a copyright violation.
I'd like to jump in here and say that, as far as I know, or we know, nobody from the RIAA is actually here.
Yeah, how come they don't?
Okay, well, they were invited, were they not?
Yes.
So, we hope they would be. So, I'd like to invite Alec back here. Who knows, I'm going to jump on him. We've talked before. Not necessarily to defend the RIAA, but if possible to give some perspective from that side of the matter.
Well, so not delving into the specifics of the thing that was just raised here, I mean, the perspective, I guess, from a content owner's side of the fence is there is a huge problem with the amount of file sharing that's going on specifically on college campuses. Last year, a group called the LAK Group did a survey based on consumer surveys of file sharing across the globe, just with movie content, and showed that of the $1.2 billion that we're losing in the US to all kinds of different copyright infringement, 44% of that, over $500 million, is due to college students. So it's a huge economic problem for us. We're losing $500 million a year to college students. Primarily.
Now, these are people who are not buying movies or going to them.
Yeah. These are people who have specifically said, if I wasn't able to make an illegal download, I would in fact buy a legitimate copy at the prevailing market rate, not consuming one download at once. People saying, yeah, I would buy one if I couldn't get the illegal one. So we have a big problem on college campuses. We think you've got a situation where universities are supposed to be the institutions that are teaching students how to become productive members of society. In many scenarios, they are doing things to regulate student behavior when they feel student behavior is illegal. In many cases, they're taking activity, I'd love to get into the technology issues, where they made decisions that we don't want viruses on our network. We figured that would harm us. So we're going to have antivirus software that's going to look for specific files coming across the network, identify it as a virus, and say, we're going to cut that off. You're not allowed to do it. They made affirmative decisions that we're going to have spam filters on the network that not only are going to look at fingerprints, but are going to actually read people's emails and see if the words under 21 are in there, or Viagra or whatever. And we're going to affirmatively decide not to let that content through the network. And we think that there are very simple things that universities can do in four different areas. Education, we can talk about enforcement of education, providing legal services, but particularly technology that can stop the illegal activity that is rampant, that is there, and do it in a way that is relatively not intrusive, and not very costly, and in fact, should be something universities want to do to protect their students. I mean, we didn't send out the pre-litigation letters, but I'll stop on this, but you know, the idea of a pre-litigation letter seems to be, let's figure out a way to educate a student that they can be caught, they have been caught, in a way that doesn't sully their name, they're not dragged into court, their future career isn't threatened. We can do this in a simple way that won't cost that much if the university cooperates, or if the university chooses not to cooperate, the student is thrown at the mercy of the courts, which it seems like, again, we're not sending those out. This is the kind of thing that universities should welcome doing because it allows them to protect their students.
I
think it's a really interesting point you brought up about looking for spam and other things. The methodology that I've heard of is that generally RIA has companies like Media Enforcers and other places like ATSP that essentially stalk people. I mean, that's probably a strong word, but they go after different IPs and they track them down. As a university, I think it might be compelling to simply block these IPs from entering the university network space and filter out their packets as hostile. Because they do cost students and university money. We're spending a lot of time and resources having to deal with what are essentially online stalkers. And I'm sorry to paint you in that picture, but I mean, this is how students are doing these days. We're like prey, and we're trying to extort from us.
So, in other words, do you think the university should stop any attempt to protect rights and instead
take affirmative
activity to insulate students?
Absolutely. I think they should continue educating students that it is wrong to illegally file shares. They should continue the education programs, but they should also keep out the people trying to harm their students from the university's network. If you want to continue sending letters to the ISPs, that's great. But the university, in my opinion, should start taking steps to protect their students on their university network.
Well, what do you think about the idea of using the filtering technology that was especially used?
Filter out media and media enforcement?
No, no, no.
Unfortunately, this starts up an entirely new argument around fair use and how do we automatically and programmatically protect those rights against not fair use. I think there were some fruitful discussions that were started yesterday around, say, common areas where no one would sue around fair use, but unfortunately, the arguments evolved, and everyone went back to their stances.
Okay, if a filtering technology can 99% accurately always stop someone from downloading a complete file of one of our movies, that's what the technology does.
Temporarily.
Exactly. Okay.
So it's a temporary fix, and it's an arms race, and any solution like that is temporary at best. As soon as it's installed, half an hour later, it's about
it. As with any virus software, it constantly has to be updated. Okay, so yes, that's true. But if the technology can temporarily, and then needs to be updated, 99% effectively, be focused on only stopping someone from downloading a printed copy of a movie, would you support that?
It's not clear it's technically possible.
Yeah, as
that's what I'm asking. But it's a hypothetical. You should get a chance.
Essentially, it's alluring, but I have to agree with him. I'm from a technology background. I don't know that you could.
Encryption works.
Yes, encryption works very, very well. And if you talk to any analyst,
that's why FreeNet is so popular.
They will tell you that the signature race is a lost cause.
Yeah.
If you could figure out how to do it heuristically, you would probably win the Nobel Prize in science because it's such a tough technical problem. That you're not, and again, how would you figure out what is a fair use?
I'm trying to get to the values discussion, whether your values and mine are the same. And
this
apparently
isn't a values.
But that's the issue. Do we share the same goal of stopping illegal file sharing or not?
Actually, let me jump in and say something. Because, first of all, the phrase file sharing seems to me to cover a wide area, wider than music downloads. Is that right?
That's the only reason we're interested.
Yeah, but it seems to me you have to add the nuance to the category. And I should first of all say I do share your value in the proprietary work. People should pay for it. People should not take it illegally. I'm a copyright holder. I care about that. I also share your concern about education. I think that cyber ethics or whatever you call it should be part of education. I probably think of cyber ethics as a wider category than some people in the content industries do. I mean, I would teach the history of copyright back to the 17th century and sort of debates over how it's been formed and why it's been formed this way and what it prevents and what it allows and First Amendment issues and on and on. So I would open up the ethical and educational package fairly widely. So one of my concerns about file sharing is that it has so many other uses. The file sharing, generically, is a very valuable tool. And one of the ethics of the university is the sharing of knowledge. And one way now that we can share knowledge is through file sharing. So you can't come in and simply say, file sharing is the problem.
You know, but I didn't say that. Whoa. I said if we can stop the illegal file transfers, not the technology, not the protocol, legal file sharing, go at it. I'm saying if you can stop the illegal file sharing, would you do it if you could? Do we share that value or not? Let the protocol live, fine.
The principle of what you said, though, isn't just stopping illegal file sharing, right?
That's what I said every time. I never said.
But you're putting out any fair use as well, right?
Illegal file sharing is not a fair use.
No, it's a technology, right? The problem is that it begs the question between what is illegal and what is not illegal. And one of my complaints about the pre-litigation letters, which I understand the position of them, but it assumes a crime has been committed. And we don't yet know until you've done all the forensics around whether this was a fair use or not.
Well, let's refine the question. If you could filter out the transfer of full television programs and movies from sources which had not been licensed to disseminate, would you support that?
But hold on, let me give you an example. I mean, there are exemptions under fair use for the transfer of
a full motion picture.
Yep. There are exemptions around the hearing disabled and the blind. There are categories in which you can take an entire file. So it's a true exception, but nonetheless. That's what the law is built on.
There are several hands up on this side of the room which we've been neglecting. Isaac's one, and there are two others over here.
Just to answer that about would I support technology to monitor at the source full movies and salon support being monitored? No. This is my house. I spend more time on this machine than I do awake.
What are you doing here?
Any sort of technology like that could be deployed without putting things on my computer which would make me uncomfortable. Things which aren't a program which isn't accountable to me, which may be working ostensibly against my interests, regardless of whether or not the legality of those interests has been determined. And it feels, frankly, a bit invasive. And if you're and scaling that problem up, say it's not my laptop, but the subnet gateways here at Harvard, or the servers who sit along the border, that's overhead. It's invasive, and it also just reduces network performance generally. I mean, some people think now that BitTorrent traffic exceeds ordinary HTTP traffic on the web. In which case, like a majority of the stuff Harvard's internet connection is passing will need to be filtered and processed, so on and so forth. And that's going to reduce the performance of the network. It places Harvard in the position of having to do the dirty work of some other organization. And it's an instruction of the technology which Harvard has legally purchased and licensed. It's saying, now you need to take a chunk of that and use it for a purpose that Harvard as an entity or its constituent users is very useful.
Oh, a couple points. One, I assume that illegal file sharing is a purpose for which Harvard University does not condone its students using the network.
That
so you're
correct.
you're talking about an act, you're engaged in act, not you. Well, you said it was legal. So you've got power. So I don't want to make this personal. File sharing is a purpose of the network. But I want to get to a couple of responses. I mean, this technology is rolled out on 70 campuses across the country already. So I want to ask, first of all, are you saying that these 70 universities somehow are violating all of these academic principles? Secondly,
you're suggesting, and 70 colleges or universities, colleges, universities have decided to use this kind of technology, that it is the job of an infrastructure provider to protect somebody's rights. And that's your basic premise. Would it be the job of the telephone company to monitor the phone line to be sure somebody isn't swearing or doing threats? Where does it end? Where does it end that other people are doing your work for you? I happen to feel very strongly as a copyright holder, as somebody who writes weekly comic, that copyright is very important. I do not believe it is the job of the infrastructure provider to police the use of that infrastructure to protect somebody else's rights.
It's an interesting box that content owners are put in. They're told you shouldn't bring lawsuits.
I'm not saying
there's a box here. You're maybe one side of the box, there's another side of the box.
I don't think anybody says you shouldn't bring lawsuits. I think that's an overspecification. There was a big argument over the particular way that lawsuits are being brought. But I mean, somebody steals your stuff, they deserve to get sued. And it's very hard to argue against that other than
I think a lot of people say that the lawsuits shouldn't be brought. I mean, I think that's
not the way they are, perhaps. But that's different than saying you don't sue somebody who steals your stuff.
If I can for a second, and I would only then just want to add to that point, even if it is 44%, I know that those statistics vary by who's doing the research. Why don't you ask the other percent, which would be the commodity ISPs, to do it too? Everyone has to do it, and higher education will do it. But why are we focused? The content industry for technological solutions.
Because you're not. I mean, we do ask the commercial ISPs. I'm sorry, you're just not part of those discussions. We have discussions with them all the time about this.
I don't see them.
But you're saying there's a concentration at the universities, and that's
no. I'm saying we do. We spend it. You're the university, so when we're talking to you, we're talking to you. We talk to commercial ISPs just as much, and in all kinds of different contexts. It's not just about the universities.
Are they installed this software?
Some commercial websites have, some commercial, I don't think commercial
ISPs
have, but quite a few
websites.
But my point is we talk to everyone about doing this.
I don't know if other ISPs install.
I'm not aware of a major commercial ISP yet. And then just in terms of your questioning of the statistics, what research do you have that you said contradicts my research?
I'll share it with you.
I'd love to hear about it, because as far as I know, we have the only numbers.
Without getting into details about numbers and all that.
So you said you undermined my statistic by saying another statistic.
Of course there are.
So you're going to assume the statistics
are correct. But that's not the point, right?
I'd be happy to assume that your statistics are correct. That you had, the number was, what, 300 million?
500 million.
500 million. But you're not. Are you taking against that? Are you doing the other side as well, people who wouldn't have purchased content unless they had first file shared it? Because I have a lot of music on my computer right here that I illegally acquired. That I don't like at all. It's just really bad. I just haven't gotten around to deleting it yet. I would have never purchased it. And that's not what I'm saying. But there's also music that I have purchased because of that. Because I have listened to it. Just like with the radio. You're giving me free content. But I'm going to buy some of that content. And a lot of it, anything that's RAA affiliated that I happen to like, I'll never buy it, ever. What I will do is I'll go to the concerts, I'll go to the shows, I'll buy t-shirts, I'll attend them. I'll do that. I'll support them in other ways.
Well, actually, none of that supports your RAA. That only supports your artist, which is fine. The point.
Which is
fine.
That's the point. Okay, content. Content does support distributors, labels. It does support them. Just not
okay, so we need to give other people a chance to talk over here.
Do we want to stop illegal file sharing? Yeah, is the solution technological fixes? No, why don't we just decriminalize file sharing? I mean, that's as simple a solution. I'm not advocating that. I'm saying that's as simple a solution as saying, why don't we all install filters? Because the difficulty with both the technological argument and the legal arguments are that you're arguing for a technological or a fix to what is not a technological or a legal problem. It's a cultural issue. And you're arguing that the cultural issue should be ignored because it protects the market. So what you have is a cultural and a market issue that you're trying to fix via technological and legal means. And that, I think, is why there are fundamentally disagreements and why figures can be produced that are always going to contest and will be alternatives.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The cultural issue has to be addressed. But I think it's addressed by trying to have an open, honest, and frankly, more balanced discussion over the cultural norms that are emerging here and whether they're good for society or bad for society.
I don't know whether this is about society. I think this is about business.
Well, it's about creation. That's what.
No, it's not about creation. It's about business. Work continues to be created. Work continues to be shared. And so ultimately, the argument, and this comes down to you, to the counter argument there, and this comes down to the counterpoint there about, you know, going to shows doesn't support the RAA. Well, that's a business question. That's not a cultural question. It's not a creative question. That's a question for the RAA as a business institute. And I'm not saying it should be destroyed or devolved or anything like that. All I'm saying is it seems to be trying to fix what is a market problem.
You started with the presumption work continues to be creative. I think you have to question that presumption. You have to question whether my company is going to employ 350 to 500 people in all walks of life to make the next Knocked Up, whatever the next movie is we make. This is a good one. Very good reviews. Is that next work going to be created if the revenues that can be generated from that movie aren't going to be sufficient to make a profit?
And I personally believe it will, but what we profit from this, the revenue margins that we hold and the modes of production that we employ, will change.
Okay, so it's over here.
Argument used to bring in videotape recording.
You could jump in. You're gonna have to.
I agree, and Josh is right about pretty much right now. But I do think that certainly the culture is built on top of the market, so I'm trying to get rid of it. But we're the Chatham House rule thing is still in effect here.
What's that? Go ahead. I can barely hear you because Lisa is talking. So, can you mind letting us jump?
Are we off the record here?
Yeah,
is the
are we
question.
Off the record?
Are we off the record? What's the record?
Oh, yeah, well, screw it.
What's the record? Go, just talk.
You know, you came very close before to ask. Well, let me also say this is kind of a man off the street interview because I don't know. I differ with some of the other students here, I assume, because I don't know as much about most of the students in the room about these issues. But I am a student at the college. I have received a cease and desist order, too, which, by the way, I did cease and desist. but you came very close before to asking if we had some magic box which could only, you know, get rid of fair use questions, actually stop file sharing, would you want it? Oh, we didn't say hands down no. We didn't say hands down yes. I'm like, that's the answer. No, I wouldn't want it. I can get all your stuff for free now. Well, I mean, why do I want to let it? But, and this is interesting, I wasn't here yesterday for the similar panel, but when I got the report, surprisingly, it sounded like the academics in the room, the professors, were on the side of the content owners, kind of against the students. I was trying to figure out why. And
That's not true.
The idea was that, and it makes a lot of sense in some ways, because when Professor Nesson called in yesterday and said the thing we're missing from the morning session was, why are the content people here? Why are they helping us figuring out what it means to give some of this stuff away? And it seemed like the answer, I think it was you gave yesterday, and maybe I misinterpreted it, but it's that, you know, we want to establish this system and we want to, you know, help get some stuff away so that there's an education about it and so it's clear what the system is, and that beyond what we're giving away, we're giving something away, but beyond that there are rules, and that's not to be given away, that's not to be stolen. And that's where the professors, I would imagine, would come in. What we're trying to do is educate the student population about cyber ethics and about the system. And as a student, I feel like that's something to be gained. When you're talking about all the legal advice and all the sorts of things that can be given to students in these resources in that situation, that's something students can be gleaned. As well as yesterday in the student work group, we were talking about, you know, yeah, we can use, there are fair use issues for even, you know, whole movies. If you're doing media studies, sometimes you need to transfer that, and maybe we can Trojan horse in defense of all of them through that. I don't know if that's true, but if we can get those resources and we can use economies of scale to get these deals where recording industry, you know, and MIA, you get tons more value to the music because you're doing it through the university as opposed to suit. I feel like that's
Can I ask you a question? What were you asked to cease and desist doing, just so I know?
I had I uploaded some...
You were on the upload, was it just uploading or downloading or both?
I had downloaded Sopranos through... Kazaa or something like that.
And you got a subpoena from?
It wasn't a subpoena. It was a
I'm sorry, wrong word. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a cease and desist, from the college computer services. They'd been passed along. They said we got a notice about your IP address. And apparently it's because I'd uploaded to other people, which I didn't realize I was doing, not that I downloaded it. But I stopped doing the photo.
So it had an education. What did you learn?
What's that?
What did you learn?
No, the fact is, I emailed him back and I said, if allegedly this had occurred, what would someone in my situation do? And they said, look, you know, they presented me to some people and they gave me some answers. I, for other reasons, coincidentally, I started going to free culture meetings a couple weeks ago, so I haven't gotten the jump on this. But had I not, I feel like if there were these resources in place, that this is something that can be given to students, and this is something where, even if you're only teaching them so they don't go, you know, don't go to jail or whatever, it's a way to teach them. And I think there's maybe something to be done.
You had to take a test as a freshman on copyright, and you had to pass that in order to go on the net.
Yeah, but, well, then maybe it should be harder, because I just checked. And there's a really good thing to show. If anyone wants, there's a copy of the Harvard Interactive Media Review out in the lobby. But for that, we were trying to use images for this. And we ran into all sorts of problems about, we had no idea what copyright was. Well, I didn't do this. I had no idea what was useless. And we had to learn it all on the fly because, you know, it really isn't educated. Maybe that's somewhere where the industry
is. You've had your arm up for so long, you're holding it with your other arm, so.
I just want to address, you asked, so hypothetically, if we could have a 99% accurate filter, to filter out content, and I think that type of hypothetical is an impossible hypothetical to make because it's not based on reality, and in reality, even a 99% accurate filter will have that 1% false positive rate, that the trade-offs of which we sort of need to address and see if we're okay with. Because, for example, in high school, they had this filter or firewall, whatever you want to call it, that would block certain websites that had certain keywords on it. And the outcome turned out to be that not only would it block pornographic websites, it also blocked websites that were health studies of nature because they used the word breast. And so I don't think we can just ask the question, would you support a filter that's 99% accurate without sort of addressing some of the problems with it, like it will block content that is not, let's say, you know, 1% of content that's not copyrighted or that's not illegal. And I think the problem becomes when it's framed, like, if you don't support it, you support piracy, whereas maybe you don't support it, you support, you don't think it's the good trade-off to have.
Well, I think that's exactly the point, and the way I phrased it was that way, because trying to figure out whether, even if there's no solution that's ever perfect, okay, certainly no technological solution, certainly no cultural solution, there are always going to be committed people who go out and get it, but trying to figure out whether there's agreement that the reality that's going on campus right now, which is massive illegal file swapping, not fair use, illegal file swapping, whether that reality is considered a problem by people in this audience that deserves to be fixed, if there was a solution that would still have some trade-offs that might be, in certain 1% of cases, a blocking of a file that was not otherwise illegal. But the point is to try to figure out whether anyone even thinks that's a good enough trade-off. 99% accuracy to deal with a massive problem is worth it for a 1% risk. And I'm not hearing a lot of agreement with that.
I think it was first here and then a couple more over there.
Right. I think, you know, the original hypothetical you posed is actually quite interesting. And the answer to it we've largely been hearing are empirical answers that we can't do it because of X, Y, Z. But I'm you know, a philosophy concentrator. I deal with impossible hypotheticals all the time. And to me, it seems eminently reasonable to say that, you know, if there is a costless possibility, if there was, and maybe there isn't because there are very rarely costless possibilities, but if there was, totally costless, you know, no legal repercussions, no social repercussions, nothing.
No money.
No repercussions whatsoever that would allow us to enforce a social agreement that we have all agreed to. And I'm sure there are some in this room who wouldn't agree to it, but the fact is that we have agreed to it. We agreed to obey the law when we entered into this social contract. Would we do it? Absolutely, I would do it. I mean, why wouldn't you? If, you know, you're saying all other things being equal, do you enforce the law? Of course you do. Why wouldn't you? And I think it's reasonable to ask that question. Do we have the underlying agreement? Do we agree that these principles are ones that we should enforce? And I would say that if it was costless, yes, but, you know, then you have to look at the costs.
Okay, over here, you had your hand up.
Yeah, to me it seems like we're trying to impose well-worn methodologies that have worked fine in another era on a whole new sort of situation. And I was talking this morning, I was in a fair use panel, or the conference group, or work group. And it seems to me that in a way, we're all sort of mired in the trees and can't sort of see a bigger picture here. And in a way, what I would like to suggest is that there might be some ideal result that we can sort of envision and then figure out a way to get there that may involve some kind of changing of the fundamental principles of copyright law to something that would take, since now works are liberated from containers, and so the notion of control, which worked fantastically well for centuries, no longer really makes sense as a default. So I think in a way, I would, you know, that people care about your content is great. And so trying to figure out a way to monetize that behavior and instead of trying to sue people or instead of trying to maintain your control, can't there be some way we can sort of envision this ultimate consumer experience where they're trading stuff they love, but trying to figure out a way to monetize it under the hood so you don't sue people and we sort of, I think that the notion of it being wrong or right is sort of tied to an earlier sense of what's possible. Now it's a whole new sense of what's possible. So I think we have to sort of think about how we can make that behavior be consistent with the values of copyright to incentivize creativity and to give people a fair return on their on what they've done. But I think we're trying to impose a sort of a horse and buggy methodology on in a Star Trek kind of era.
If I could just interject one thing, I mean, yeah, so one other way to open up this discussion is to talk about alternative compensation models than the one that we're trying to operate under. And instead of trying to find a technological fix for this complicated social and cultural problem, rejigger the way the money flows. And I mean, for example, Terry Fisher has this book called The Promises to Keep, which has some suggestions about other ways to both value and monetize creativity and have content creators recompense. So that's another window out of the tangle that this discussion keeps getting into.
Well, I mean, you know, we're doing it. Okay. You can stream our television shows, all the ones we own, and all our news programs from our website, and you have to watch a pre-roll ad. Okay. So you got to watch an ad, but they're all there available. You can download our TV shows from a variety of sources, and soon more sources, whether it's iTunes, whether it's Amazon Unbox, for $1.99 per episode, you can get it without ads. You can stream our movies from peer-to-peer sources, like Peer Impact. I know Warner Brothers is licensed to BitTorrent. You've got ability to download and burn through Cinema Now, through media, through several different sources, Walmart, download the burn, make backups. You've got all these different options that we're out there trying to monetize right now, and they're not making any money, because free is a better option.
Well, I trust it pretty well.
A data point on there. Half the people who download music, according to stats that came out 2 weeks ago, half the people download music do it legally, half do it illegally, approximately. The number of downloads is vastly higher than the Amazon, there's no question on the music thing. But it's actually half the household, half the people are now doing it legally because there's a method of doing it that's easy to use, it's cost effective, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's been proven that alternative models can work. It's not clear what the return on RIAA's return on investment of the work that they're doing is when we've got proof that actually some models can work. It may be that the models that you've tried so far aren't ones that the customers have liked. It's possible as that. It's possible also that it's illegal downloads. It's hard to tell. But I don't think it's time to dismiss the ability of entrepreneurs such as the movie industry to actually do something customers want. I think it's possible that can be done.
I think that's what, if you believe in market economics, that's clearly what our companies are doing.
But I want to point out something I yelled at a little. Almost all the arguments you're using are exactly the arguments that we're using pre-Sony case on payment, on videotape. The movie industry lost that case and made hundreds of billions of dollars. If they won the case, they wouldn't have had that money.
That's interesting. To a certain extent, the reason that I don't go through a lot of those venues is the DARPA issue, and Microsoft should know a lot about this. that if you lock something up and make it accessible for a price, and there's something unlocked up, if I want the best quality, I get to go to the unlock chain, and where am I going to get that? It's going to be free. Now, this, there are two things, and I think in the spirit of Charlie Nesson, as he circles around the room somewhere, is that we can work out a compromise. There are a lot of compromises. One would be compulsory licensing, right? That's maybe more for music than it is for video. But this would be good. This, I think, a lot of people would be comfortable with. Second would be making it accessible to universities to say, for all of our content, you can file share it freely. Have, you know, and people who want to opt into this can pay a small amount of money. Students can pay $5 as part of their tuition to do that. I would totally do that. And then that money, you know, using some sort of elementary monitoring system, the same way that we monitor outgoing spend. A lot of universities don't do that for a lot of really good reasons that I don't want to get into. We can keep track of that, and there can be an organization that divvies that out. I'd be completely comfortable with that. But I think education is the most important thing. I think explaining to people what legal file sharing is, what illegal file sharing is, and how to respect the network is important. Because if you're not going to be able to do it with Comcast to get the technology there, you're going to have a harder time doing it with a major university like ours.
A couple points. One, do you like the breadth and variety of movies and television shows that exist today?
That's a completely fallacious argument.
Yes.
It's not an argument, it's a question.
I have not the argument.
Well, the will die if we don't get our money is exactly the same arguments made with every single technology advance.
That's not where I'm going. If you like the amount and breadth of creativity out there today, you have to admit that part of what has inspired that, if not the majority of what's inspired that, is the current copyright system and how it enables us to be compensated for what we do. So before you throw the baby out,
I'll respond to your question.
Let me make my two points on
your
two points.
Absolutely.
The second one is, you say you can be comfortable with the compulsory license system. Just as comfortable as you are with the compulsory license system that has come up with the webcasting rates and now everyone in this room is protesting.
That's not compulsory. That's not.
That is compulsory.
What I'm saying is, it's not compulsory the same way that I'm talking about, right? Because that's essentially the RAA and other organizations saying this is how much you're going to pay.
No, it's a government body setting the rate. It's a compulsory.
Yeah, because the negotiation table isn't equal.
Of course, it's equal. It's
no.
A government.
So
wait a minute. You'll only be comfortable with a compulsory license rate.
Do it with open doors. Don't have a single license. Don't have the RAA negotiating it out for different organizations.
That's not what happened. By the way, I can actually take credit for writing the CARP law, the new CRDRA, because I was in Congress and I wrote it. We totally changed the system explicitly to address the procedural concerns about the webcasting industry and the small webcasters with their access to the system. Instead of being an arbitration rate where the parties had to pay for their participation in their process and pay the fees for the arbitrators, we created a government-paid system. Let the small webcasters go and participate in the process, not have to pay anymore. Removed all the procedural burdens.
So
this is the small webcaster rate that is now gone. Is that correct?
This is the process by which the new webcasting rates were set, which are now being protested by.
It's an open process, a fair process. Why did 100% of the result be what the copyright holders?
Is it possible that the government judges actually agree with? Is that possible?
It is conceivable that they were perfect, that the proposal was perfect. It is conceivable. The divinity school's down the street.
There are several things that are overlapping here. So there's the original CARP rates, but the CARP has since been dissolved. Is that right? And now there's just the Copyright Royalty Board.
Yeah.
Okay.
For webcast.
And so the Copyright Royalty Board, a 3-person panel, convened by Congress to settle the matter. Heard the case by the webcasters and by SoundExchange, and sided with SoundExchange, essentially. And that's where we are now. Okay, and now, she's disappeared, but in the back row, she just submitted some litigation on behalf of the NPR.
NPR,
yeah. So this is a different can of worms, but I guess it's the same. Is it the same can of worms or is it a different can of worms?
The compensation system is how all the compulsory license rates are set. My point is,
be careful what you wish for.
I'd like to at least get to that table so that we can get screwed over by the RA in that way too. I'd at least like to have the opportunity to have to do that. But we're not even talking about that, right? Like that's something that's, that RA is never going to get compulsory licenses for all music, right? That's not even possible. But for things that are possible, for, again, I'd be willing to pay into, you know, I'd be willing to pay a certain amount of my tuition to pay for legal file sharing, my own or for others, and to make legal file sharing. I'd be willing to do that.
So you're saying you'd be willing to accept whatever the government set rate was, even if it was one.
Even how it's worked out university to university. I'm willing, I have faith in my university.
So now you're talking not compulsory, but you mean an actual voluntary negotiation.
That would be fine.
I think that's what content owners do, they negotiate.
But not
and
but
we're
not,
happy
but,
to negotiate but with anyone who wants to buy our content.
Negotiations always come out to my university being offered something that isn't free for me to do what I want with it in the traditional ways, and to consume it on my own terms. It's something that I can stream for a limited amount of time. And with that, you have the darknet issue. I'm gonna get it somewhere else and it's gonna be a free place that I get it. And that's your major concern. Because technology is always going to be, it's always going to be easier for me to steal content from you than it is for you to prevent your content from being stolen. So you have to give me a way of paying for it. And I'm offering them. You know, it's not that I don't want to pay for your content.
That's a legitimate question in a way. I just want to jump in here because the part of the framework of the Copyright Royalty Board decision that was provided by the CART process, by the DMCA in the first place, was the notion of a willing buyer and willing seller. And the assumption that we would not be able to find those, so we're just going to impose some rates based on a hypothetical buyer and seller. You're proposing a real buyer and seller,
yeah,
in a way. Okay. I think that's cool. And actually, we're working on something like that at the Berkman Center right now. So, and later we can talk about that if you're interested. But I think that it's not the end of the road.
We're talking about downloading music for a minute, that don't do it for me. There's two ways that I know of to download music legally. One is the iTunes model, where you pay 99 cents to get a song. Well, I'm a classical music listener, I have no idea what a song is. How many songs are there in different demos? I have no idea. You've got an hour-long symphony, is it one movement, is it 10, 99 cents a song? I don't care what it is. Yeah. If you're...
Apple's monetized.
You know, okay. But the important thing is also if you're in the world of pop music and you like hits and you like stars, that's fine. There's a huge variety of music out there that record companies don't know anything about and that isn't profitable enough perhaps for them to find out anything about. A huge amount of it is online. I do a lot of downloads. As far as I know, they're all legal. None of them have anything to do with big record companies. I go through, I don't know, Google Web, Internet Archive, some songs that have old recordings. I think the variety of music, and again, I'm trained in musicology and I happen to love the variety of music, is absolutely fascinating, and it's possible that if this stuff was on CD and sold by companies that the RIAA is behind, I would pay for it, but it's not out there. There's no variety, as far as I'm concerned, in hearing the same pop star under 50 different names 100 times. You wonder why the CD sales are down. It's not because people can download stuff for free. I download stuff for free, and if I can find a CD, but I go out and buy it. It's because there's nothing there people want. And you consider the range of music is this big, and got that much in the, for sale. So how do you?
Well, yeah, again,
hang on. I'm sorry. I forgot where I was going. Now I'm but these people that are making this stuff and putting it in Creative Commons and putting it on Internet Archive or wherever. Where do they make their money? Well, they make a day job. But besides that, I think they plan on getting exposed that way. They plan on maybe they do concerts. They get small circles of people who know about them, and those become larger circles over time. Or they don't, and their small circles are great. If you're not into the star system, you don't need massive distribution. I'm wondering why more of the people who are recording now don't go to that model and say, I'll make my money by becoming known to some people and performing for them, and I'm doing all the MP3 stuff to get some publicity. Michael Jackson may not need it, but it works for a lot of people.
The internet is a tremendous opportunity for an artist, a recording artist, to go directly to the consumer. It's a great business model, and I agree, I don't know why more people don't do it. It doesn't work so well for TV and movies. I mean, just to throw an example, I hope, just by the demographic here, some of you all are heroes of this. Yeah, okay. Maybe we got one. So here else, you know, one of our only, in fact, successful new movie of this fall, or this past season. Well, Heroes, incredibly expensive show to make, and we're doing a lot to promote it. It came out, we didn't even know that it was going to be a successful show. It was probably the least heralded in our line. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which Warner Brothers actually produces, but we air, Black Donnelly's, The Office, My Name is Earl. All these shows are ones that we have much higher hopes for. A couple of them are done. Our huge investment in Friday Night Lights, another example. Big investments, Friday Night Lights, Studio 60, and Black Donnelly's and some of our other shows, they're off the air right now. Our investment in them is gone. We've lost all that money. We're hoping to make it up on the one hit, on Heroes. And we would never have made Heroes if we had a more limited pool of capital. That would have been the last show we would make. The other ones were the ones that we thought were more successful. Would have more commercial appeal. You have to have the ability to recruit from Heroes, not only the broadcast rights, but now what we're doing with streaming online, making them available to download, doing ad support stuff, to make back the money that we lost on all the other shows. And so in the television and movie side, you're talking about, I don't think, something that can be replicated by the actors and the writers getting together for 22 weeks and finding some place to film on their own and producing the same show on their own without basically someone to bring together the talent and the capital. And
TV is a different model.
And it's a source of major revenues. Advertising revenue is still high. I mean, all this talk about the fact that the artists can afford of the television advertising industry is all flawless. I mean, I admit that there's been a change in the rates that you can charge for ads, but it's not like television has become unprofitable. And you know what? You put Heroes online, but you don't put ads in it. Because I watched the entire thing online without seeing a single ad from your official site.
From the Heroes site?
Mm-hmm.
There's ads all around. And typically they're pre-rolled.
Yeah, and you click full screen and I don't see any ads.
Yeah.
It has ads in it, but you don't see anything.
Don't tell him this
will
fix that problem.
The system says
thanks for debugging this problem. Christina, you wanted to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that, I mean, it does sort of not on the same level that music has, and that's just because, you know, the technology hasn't caught up yet, but there are a number of shows that are very, very popular, distributed entirely over the internet, that are, you know, like lots of people watch, maybe not as many as Heroes, because not as many people have TVs, but, like Dean over there started this project called Make Internet TV, which is encouraging, in fact, and teaching other people how to make their own shows. So it's definitely doable. And I mean, like, you can't really expect us to pay for the fact that, like, the people who did your marketing research messed up on those shows. I mean, I don't see why people like our age would be expected to pay for that kind of thing.
I think it's a good argument that was made by drug companies, right? That we have to do a lot of research and development. A lot of the things we create are never going to be used. But the ones we're going to be used, you're going to be glad that we have enough money to work on the variety of different things. And I think when you try to make the argument, it doesn't work because a drug that comes out, if you spend less money on researching it, it's going to be a worse drug. A TV show that comes out, if you don't spend, you know, millions of dollars, if you're not paying people millions of dollars, individual people millions of dollars, and collectively a lot of money into that show, it's going to be a much less show. I would continue to watch Heroes if it wasn't made with as much money. But the fact is that for the current model that you use, and that's used for music production as well, is to throw away bad things. So if someone likes, you know, too bad, I mean, they invested into it, but if they don't like it, you cancel it, it's gone. And same for artists, they just get dropped from the label. While there's a 90% that don't make it, I think this is true for TV as well, and a 10% that makes it for everyone else. And I don't know if that's going to be sustainable, especially as you see people are just investing in other ways of watching.
Have you worked in television?
No, I haven't.
I think you're very wrong to assume that Heroes could be made for less money and that it's all inflated salaries. And there are hundreds of people that work on making television shows that have a variety of jobs. I can't even name, but you apparently don't know, from sound engineers to writers to the assistant directors.
I have more than movie production.
Okay, so you understand that it's a huge enterprise. It's not, we're companies. It's not like we waste money because we want to. We cut the budget as much as we can. We make it as cheap as we can, but the end product is what it is because of the investment.
Jump in, Lewis.
I want to come back to the universities and these questions and offer a sort of model that's been haunting me for some time. I'm much influenced by an old book by Michael Walzer called Spheres of Justice. And Walzer's thesis is, look, we have different realms of social life, like the marketplace, education, church, military, make a long list. And for Walzer, a simple form of tyranny is when one sphere of social life begins to dominate the others. So that in a theocracy, one of the things we might complain about is that people who think they have access to the word of God begin to run the military, the government, the marketplace, and so forth. In an aristocracy, people who think they have better blood than others. So this is his model, that there are spheres of, different spheres of social life, and one should be conscious of where their boundaries are, and that one ethical question always arises when one sphere begins to dominate another. So this is partly how I look at the tension between the content industries and the university. I think the values of these two institutions are different in many ways. There was a letter sent to freshmen incoming at the University of Southern California last year, which made the odd declaration that the purpose of the university was to create and protect intellectual property. And you know, many who work at universities think this is not the purpose of the university, that it has other purposes, that in fact, a lot of knowledge is not at all adequately defined as intellectual property. It is not property at all. There's a long tradition of treating ideas as contributions, that there's a gift exchange economy, which is a better way to organize, for example, a scientific community than a propertized economy. And to my mind, one thing that, the reason that the pre-litigation letters rub me the wrong way is it seems to me an example of a kind of ongoing blurring of the boundaries between two different communities of value. And that the universities need to be very clear about what it is that they do, the preservation, the creation, the dissemination of knowledge across generations, and ask when the recording industry comes with its set of values, do these match or not? And when they don't, to resist it.
I'm monopolizing, I know, but I just want to make a point there, which is, I think that's exactly right, but the question is, who is encroaching on
whom? Who's what?
Who is encroaching on whom? So a lot of what we've been talking about, not in this room, but elsewhere in this conference, is all the exciting new uses that educators, librarians, teachers want to make of new technology to do new stuff with content that they could never do before. Whether it's online distribution, whether it's digital distance learning, whether it's cutting and pasting stuff, and making digital copies in the classroom. This is stuff that wasn't done before by educators. Stuff they want to do now, rightly, because it's very useful for education, but it brings them into encroaching on what we're...
Well, but again, this then goes back to the earlier, we had a working group on fair use this morning. It may bring them into encroaching on your territory, or it may in fact be that educational uses are covered in a whole different ethic, and that there's no encroachment at all. That this is covered by fair use, and again, I'm not talking about students downloading proprietary music. If it's illegal, they should not do it. But that in the conversation of knowledge, some things that seem to be illegal in the entertainment industry are not illegal in the colleges.
Jeremy wanted to speak.
No, you know, we started with the question of if you come back to what the university should do. And we spent a long time, I think, correctly talking about the underlying behavior and how we value it. Expressing different views about it because.
Can you speak up? Sorry.
Yeah, we started with, and then we come back to the question what the university should do about illegal downloading, what I guess is the specific subject. And then I think we quite correctly spent most of the time talking about value judgments about the behavior in question. And the reason I think that's true is that I think that there are. You know, the university clearly has its role as teacher, researcher, etc. But I think that if there are clearly areas of behavior within the university's campus and community that that are illegal under laws of the land, that the university would have no question or hesitation in preventing. And wouldn't say, you know, that because it's not our role or it's not our job or we're just this, that, or the other. And what I'm hearing is that it's a at least an ambivalence about the moral negativity, if that's the right word, of the behavior that is causing this angst.
No, I don't think so.
No,
the university doesn't send cops knocking on the students' dorm rooms every night to see whether they're drinking.
It what?
The university does not send the university police to each dorm room every night to see whether they're drinking. We don't have cameras in the dorm rooms to see that they're doing illicit activities. There's a lot of things which are flatly illegal that we don't go out of our way, we don't make it a primary purpose of the university to enforce. If we
But you're not providing the means and the tools by which those things are going to be done.
Providing the dorm room.
But, you know, where we do is as an ISP, correct? Where we do is as an ISP, correct? We don't provide them with computers. Rare universities still give out computers. So the only service that we're providing is as an ISP. And I don't know of an interpretation of the DMCA except content owner's interpretation that suggests that when we act as a conduit, we have any liability or any responsibility. It is a provision given to allow for innovation of the internet when the DMCA was written. And it was written largely at the behest of content owners who wanted it and knew that they could not ask for anything more when you are a conduit. And so to suggest that we should be doing anything more than what we do, and millions of dollars is spent on the education programs, it's spent on acting on those notices when we don't have to, as a matter of developing citizenship for our students because we do believe in it. We listen to content owners because we care about our students, and I don't know how many meetings you have with ISPs, but I bet they don't care about their users to any degree that colleges and universities care about our students. What more really would you expect us to do in order for us to continue to fulfill our missions and not to enforce your copyrights?
Get over here.
I would strongly object to the idea that any university, anybody in this room is morally ambivalent about this stuff. I go to 38 orientation sessions a year. I meet with 19 parent sessions a year. I publish 18 messages a year about why doing this stuff is wrong. I go to orientation sessions during the first 7 days that every freshman is on campus, and I talk to every single one of them. I think we are anything but morally ambivalent.
And it's in our student handbook, and it's also online. And in fact, there are warnings about it every time you turn your computer on.
Absolutely.
If a student gets two DMCA notices at Harvard, the second time they're off the net for a year, there's no moral ambiguity whatsoever.
That's right. That's right.
But it's what many of us do. But instead, we're the ones who have brought before Congress, not the CEO of Verizon or AT&T, and told how morally immoral we are. Why is there the focus on us? Because you can't get them to come before you. You could not get the head of AT&T to come sit there.
If you'd like to go with us to Congress and try to get a hearing on Verizon, we'd be happy to go.
That's my point. You won't. We go because we care about our students. We care about their moral.
It's like saying the highway should police what's in the cars. I don't think that's the job of the highway.
Over here.
Thank you. This is, in fact, a question of competing moralities in the end and values in the end, I think. It's hard for me to see this issue apart from the end game of the U.S.-Korea free trade agreement, which ends for fair use. It's hard for me to see this apart from the proposed IPPA every year it's introduced, 2006-2007. It's also
Spell out IPPA.
Intellectual Property Protection Act. Current version is 2007. That would criminalize, that would bring all of the paraphernalia and the identity of the war on drugs to something, even attempted infringement. So the way I see this and what I've been working on is that this is another iteration of prohibition movements in the U.S. And you can look at the war on drugs, you can look at alcohol, you can look at the combination of economic interests, moral interests, demographic conflict, technological change, and that you see a lot of similar confluence. I wrote about it when I was called Policing the Convergence of Virtual Material Worlds. And so when I see this, I don't see this as an issue that is apart from these prohibition wars that have been part of American history. They have a different flavor, they take on a different a different attitude toward them. And so I would ask the people, because you're really good at this, you frame things. And at least, well, wouldn't you agree we're all moral people here? Yes. It's a master frame that you use that you can talk, I think, that you're able to use, and I've heard it all before. And it pre-structures agreement in a way that you learn to make sales, for instance. There are fundamental values around community, around identity, around the production of symbols. The very production of property rights is, in many ways, a contested domain at WIPA, for example, and other places. It's not this fixed moral realm that's straight up. So I think when we talk about this, we need to kind of understand that these larger social cultural dynamics are at play, intergenerational, that involve these different things, and in fact, they have similarities to the war on drugs. Otherwise, why would there be acid forfeiture?
Yeah, before we have 4 minutes left before we're done. I'd like to say, the question that I had going in is, what is it that we can say briefly that we're not going to agree about? And what is it that we are going to agree about? I mean, I'd like to know what ground we can't close on and where we may have made some progress.
I'll offer one. Okay. Do not ask us to put technological solutions onto our networks that remain to this day unproven, but even if they were perfect, should not be put on, because filtered speech, chill speech, and if you chill speech, you're going to chill it at the place that is most important for it to occur, and that's in higher education.
I imagine that Scott would probably second that. You've had your hand up for a long time, but...
I feel really bad, because I think there's a divergence of opinions for some of the students in the room and maybe some of the students on campus, so I think it should be reflected there's a diversity opinion. But also, I don't see why there's not moral ambivalence on the part of the university about this. With the drinking example, it's the law is being blatantly and universally disregarded, and again here, should we be okay with saying, well, we're just gonna turn our heads? Or should we say, look, and you don't need a technological solution for that, like you don't need a technological solution here with, if it were something like a violent crime or a hate crime, you don't need to go around policing everything, you just don't tolerate it, and if someone does it, they're kicked out, hands down, and they know that if the penalties are stricter. And I wonder, I mean, I feel bad that the universities are in this place. Did they have to be responsible for students who are breaking the law, but is there, and this is actually a question, sorry, but is there a way for the RIAA to get to students without the university?
Well, I think Scott just said that. If you get to a DMCA notice, it just made, you know.
No, but there's technologically no, because all a content owner knows is your ISP number. And
your IP address.
The ISP is the connection between that address and the identity.
I feel like, can't the university explain to the student, like, look, we really don't want to be doing this, but at the same time, we recognize the recording industry has no other way to get to you. Otherwise, we're saying, look, if you do this,
you've been doing for years,
if you break it twice, you're still kicked off the network.
Well, it's
like people understand
three times.
If you say you're kicked out of the university for doing it twice, it's not gonna happen.
Again, we're trying to wrap up here,
and we've got 1 minute now, so keep it brief. Isaac's had his hand up for a while. I'll sit back over here.
No,
I think we're in the drinking discussion of the university responsibility of the morality of the students changes the discussion interestingly, because it certainly, the drinking age is also not, it, particularly among younger people, understandably, it's far from consensus as far as how legitimate the 21-year-old criteria is. But, I mean, setting all that aside, nobody likes to be lawbreakers. And part of the problem with this whole situation is that, you know, there is this cultural problem, and trying to legislate that away doesn't always work out terribly well. It's possible that, you know, reforming legal frameworks may be a better path to take, because, I mean, particularly in the basic argument is that software piracy is common theft, where it's the
no, it's
more...
infringement. If I have to interrupt, and I'm sorry, Anne. Theft. It's infringement.
No, I agree with you.
You take a CD, you get petite larceny, and it is a little slap on the hand. The most minimal, one-time distribution,
$750. It's significantly greater to infringe copyright than it is to lift the physical property. So we at least need to be talking the same language. And I'm not trying to say that against you, sir. I'm trying to say it against the content industry that uses that analogy.
Which
but in
why
a way that
it's
very
interesting
accepted.
That that's used because it's not the same. It's not the same thing. It doesn't feel like the same thing. It doesn't carry the same physical repercussions. The entire experience is very different. And so to sort of arbitrarily force all of this into that framework is something which all it does is promote massive, massive disregard for the law. If something is easy to do and appears fairly victimless, there's just no, and the law is very draconian and spottily enforced. These are not the elements which combine to produce
so,
a
we need to wrap up. I just want to sort of try to tie a few threads together here. And really only two threads that I'm going to manage to get. Which one is, one argument we hear often, often from the law and economics folks in the legal camps is the least cost avoider, the most efficient enforcer should be the one where we place the burden. The university, as ISP, is in the best position to stop the activity, and so it should, or so we should be able to lean on them to do that. And the other thread was the separating the spheres of activity, as Lewis referred to Walzer's discussion. The university shouldn't be put in the position of law enforcement. We don't put it in the position of kicking students out for violating the drinking laws because it's teacher and not law enforcement. If we are asking it to kick people off its networks or and impose speech filtering technologies in the middle of the network in order to enforce market structuring rules, we're blurring those boundaries in ways that make the market dominant over other important values. So I don't think able to answer many of these questions that we've put up, but at least I hope given a few more ways to think about them.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much for attending.